WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. We have a fun one ahead here. If you're watching out on the webcam or on YouTube, you see that this is not a Baltimore Ravens jersey. This is, and it's not a Lansdowne High School jersey either, although it could pass as one. We're going to be doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour out at State Fair in Catonsville near Lansdowne, the home of Jim Schwartz, who just got that Brownies job. Holiday cash drop giveaways from the Maryland Lottery. We're going to be doing that on Friday, as well as our friends at Window Nation, 866-90-NATION. You buy two, you get two free, 0% financing for 60 months. And it is winter time and I'm digging my new windows. My cat digs my new windows. The birds are flying into it, digging the new windows. All right, this is going to be a fun segment. In my spanning the globe to bring you the constant variety of wise conversations we have here at Baltimore Positive and WNST, I have a really full, rich, beautiful life at 54 that I was celebrating during the holidays and getting up on New Year's and my wife's donor being here. And I have so many old friends on Facebook and LinkedIn and different places. And I really thought to myself, 2023 is going to be the year I go to some new places. Now, I'm seeing the same old Springsteen shows, but I am going to some new cities, new places and doing new things. And I have people that I've been wanting to invite on the show. And they've been camera shy, or I'm back of house. I'm the PR guy. And the PR guys are always the guys with the best stories. They can't tell them all. Some of them have sort of a timeline on it. Some of them, you know, the statute of limitations passes and we can find out exactly what happened in that Kevin Gilbride fight with Rex or with Buddy Ryan. But Chip Namias has been a friend. The Houston Oilers PR guy in the early 90s, when I first went on the radio as Nasty Nestor on December the 13th, 1991, then with Kenny Albert. And I called him back when I started a radio show and I said, I'm the world's biggest Houston Oilers fan. I want to have Oilers on my show sometimes. I'm a legitimate media guy. I was a newspaper guy. Can you help me? And Chip Namias took pity on me. And 30 years later, we are celebrating our friendship, our relationship, the few beverages we've had along the way at many, many Super Bowl radio rows. And he knows of my affinity for the Oilers. But I thought of him and saw him getting honored in Nashville, Tennessee by the Adams family. And he had his name in lights in Oiler blue, never to be Titan blue. And I welcome you onto the program. I'm going to put some Royal Farms coffee in my Houston Oiler mug, Chip Namias. And it is good to have you on. And I know you've done a lot of things in your life, but nothing as significant as being the Love You Blue PR guy for the Oilers of the early 90s. So welcome, man. How you been, bro?
Good, Nestor. Good to be with you. Good to see you. As you mentioned, it's been a long time. We got a lot of history together and happy to be here.
Well, you come to me in many ways, not the least of which would be that Oiler blue helmet you have over you that you put onto your set, and me and my Elvin, and this is a game-worn Elvin Bethea jersey that I ripped his name off the back because it was peeling. I mean, you know, Bud went a little cheap on the jersey, so they tore away during Earl Campbell, and the name wore off, so I put my name on the back, but this is a legitimate sand-knit team issue Elvin Bethea real jersey that I've had for 35 years. And you know of my love for the Oilers. Do you think fondly of the, I mean, it was a job for you. You worked for the Dolphins. You worked for the Bucks. I saw all the Pele stuff coming out last month, and I forget about your time in the NASL. I mean, you've had a really wonderful life in sports, and I have so many people like you in my life that I've never had you on to story tell. But like, do the Oilers, when they show that old Buffalo games, to still piss you off, or do you look back now and say, man, I worked in the NFL with Warren Moon? It was good stuff, man.
Well, when they do show that documentary on the Oilers Bills game, I always do the same thing. I DVR it, I watch it, and then when Bubba McDowell makes the interception, returns it for a touchdown, and we go up 35-3, I changed the channel.
There you go. All right. It was good right till then. You know, I watched that game with Mike Rossigliano, the famous artist here from the Baltimore Sun, who's one of my dearest friends. We talk about it all the time. You know, as we do this interview, Chip, the Ravens are interviewing Frank Reich to be their offense coordinator.
You know, I a few years ago when Frank was the offensive coordinator for the Chargers, and I was working as an NFL replay official, I saw him on the sideline a couple hours before the game, and I went up to him and I just said, "You don't know me, but you ruined my life." And he had a real puzzled look on his face, and I had to explain. I was the PR guy for the Houston Oilers, and you know, in the game.
Dude, you could have been the PR guy for the Miami Hurricanes and done the same thing, because he did that as a Terp.
I am well aware of that. You know, the amazing thing about that game that people forget that makes it even more incredible from the Bills standpoint is Buffalo didn't have their two best players. Jim Kelly and Thurman Thomas didn't play in that game. And, you know, that makes it even more painful. And, you know, you were mentioning the Oilers, and obviously that was a big part of my life. I was there for 9 years. And we just had a reunion in October. Amy Adams, who is now the owner of the Titans after her father's passing away. You know, for many years, the Houston Oilers players kind of felt like men without a country. The Titans really never brought them in or invited them to anything. And they were, a lot of them still live in Houston, and they kind of felt like, you know, we played and poured our blood and guts for an organization that doesn't technically exist anymore. And the organization that it's become doesn't pay any attention to us. Well, Amy Adams, when she got control of the team, she's changing that. And she's really brought the Oilers players back in, because that was a big part of the history of that organization from 1960 to 1995, 35 years of Oilers football. And this past October, Amy brought about 85 former Oilers players to Nashville for a beautiful 3-day weekend, which literally no expense was spared. And it was a great time to see all the old guys again and hang out for not just a day, but 3 days chock full of activities. And Amy Adams did it upright, and kudos to her for recognizing the Oilers history, which I know is important to me and important to you as well.
It's important to me, man. It is. It's the legs of my fandom that led me to cover this league at the level I covered it at for the last three decades, to become, you know, to become all purple, right? And they lived in the league very briefly. I have some pictures of me and Blaine Bishop on the field in 97, excuse me, when they closed Memorial Stadium, because the last game for the Colts was Earl Campbell and the Oilers in 83. You weren't there yet then, right? You were in Miami?
I was in Miami, but we had a last game at Memorial that in December of that last year.
So did the Steelers play here that month too. Yeah.
It was memorable. And I've never forgotten it, because that was the only time I was ever at Memorial Stadium. And I was a huge, even though it seems weird since I had no Baltimore connections, growing up, the Colts were my team. John Mackey was my guy. And I love Chuck Thompson.
John Mackey was a friend of mine, and, you know, obviously suffered at the end of his life, and Sylvia's a friend as well. It's funny you would mention that, and it's serendipity anytime I have somebody like you on, because one thing's going to leave. I have no idea where this conversation with Chip is going. It's going to involve, before we're done, it's going to involve at least one king. It's going to involve soccer, two kings, Pele and Jerry Lawler. So Chip's been, and Warren Moon as well. And Chris Dishman was a king of something, I'm sure, too. But, you know, Chip, for me, with that part of my life and loving the Oilers and being a fan, and for you to even talk about the Oiler players being wayward, you know, we had that here with all the Colts, right? Because no one could live in Baltimore and ever. I mean, Johnny U was like, "I'm not going to Indianapolis and getting anything." And John Mackey wouldn't accept his Hall of Fame ring. He accepted it here as part of the Hall of Fame, not the Hall of Fame game, the preseason Give Baltimore the Ball game, which was Dolphins and Saints in 93. And John Mackey, I was with my wife at Nacho Mama's, which is this wonderful place. The proprietor died 10 years ago. He was a dear friend of mine, a guy named Scunny, real Baltimore legend guy. Nacho Mama's. There's two locations. And we were in the Towson location the other day. My wife and I were having a margarita. We're having some delicious birria quesadillas. And there on the wall, and Scunny stole everything. Everything on the wall is some, I can say that he's been gone for 10 years, but there's a C. O-L-T-S. And they literally were from the side of the stadium. And they're probably 4 foot C, 4 foot O. And it's above the bar. And they're autographed by a couple of people. And I, you know, and I wanted to get up and figure out who signed him. John Mackey signed all five of them, the COLT and S, and you know, they're all signed by Jim Mutchler, a few of the fellas that lived a little longer, you know, than some of the others did. And so I saw John Mackey's name five times, three nights ago with my wife. And she, and my wife's like, I wonder how Sylvia is. And you know, we started talking about John. So for you to say you love John Mackey, where did you grow up? You're a Memphis guy?
I lived in New York City through first grade. And then after first grade, we moved to Memphis. I lived there through the eighth grade. And then when I was in high school, my mother got remarried and we moved to a suburb of New Haven, Connecticut. But the Colts were my team. I remember watching Super Bowl III. With my little kitty Colts helmet on in my bedroom. My heart was broken. That was a tough game to endure. And little did I know that ultimately I'd work for Coach Shula years later. But
there's another Colts king. How many kings have you been associated with, Chip?
The Colts were my team, all throughout my childhood. Mackey was my favorite player. Of course, loved Johnny U, loved Ray Perkins when he was on the Colts. And that was my team. Still remember Mike Curtis leveling the guy who was dumb enough to run out on the field with that classic, that would be that's a penalty in today's league. He horse collared him. It was great.
So let me go back to the beginning of our relationship, because I want to paint the scene of my Oiler fandom for anybody that doesn't know about it. Anybody that's been in my life a long time knows about it. So, in 1974, I went to my first Colts game, and I brought this back up with Stan White recently. My first, and I have the program, Stan White separated Joe Namath's shoulder in the game. And I just found that I ran into Stan at the Cal Ripken Foundation basketball lunch with Jay Wright and Gary Williams. They do this big thing here every year. It's beautiful. They do it in September for the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation. A little throwback, I run into Stan and I saw him and I'm like, and Stan was in the locker room for 20 years doing post-game radio. So I know Stan well. I've never taken a picture with Stan that I'm aware of. I did find one of me, him and Burt Jones together at an old banquet 20 years ago. But I said to Stan, I want to take a picture with you, man. Because I always have said to Stan since I was a very young man, since as long as I've known you, Stan was a celebrity here in the 90s. He ran the indoor soccer team for a long time. He had gyms. And the first time I met him, I said to him, Stan White, you sacked Joe Namath the first game I went to. Oh, thank you very much, young man. You know, like 30 years ago. So every time I see Stan, I remind him. It was a great game for him. But he told me, he's like, we threw 8 interceptions in that game, Nestor. I'll never forget it. And I'm like, what? How is that possible? You threw 8 interceptions. I looked it up online. I went back September 10th, 1974. Burt Jones threw 4 I'm losing the name here. I said Marty Dommers threw 4. So he threw 8 interceptions in the game. They lost 34-7 to the Jets. Joe Namath got his shoulder separated. And that was the beginning of my first football game. My dad took me to. I was 5 years old. I wasn't even 6 yet. I remember it vividly. I sat in the outfield, which you could never do at a baseball game, Memorial Stadium. You know, they opened the outfield, the seats out there. They put a little rope up. The band was out there, the cheerleaders, the line, all of that. And on the way out of the stadium, honest to God, Chip, on the way out of the stadium, there was a man selling pennants and banners when we got the bus right in front. The NFL films used to always capture that. Get your pennants, scorecard, program. Yeah. On the way out, my dad was so pissed at the Colts. They had just dealt Johnny U to the Chargers. And my dad was so pissed off that when I went out, I wanted a pennant, a banner. And I looked at the Oiler blue and I loved the helmet. And I said, I want that one, Pop. And he's like, well, I'll get you that. And he must have made a deal with the guy because I have the Chargers one too. The Dan Fouts, you know, that. So I have a Chargers one and an Oilers one that my father bought for me. And I fell in love with the Oilers that day. I always loved the Oilers. A couple of years later, they drafted Earl Campbell. The Oilers played on the night that Jimmy Carter was elected. On that Monday night before that Tuesday, and I had off from school. I was in third grade, and the Oilers were in Baltimore. Monday Night Football, Howard Cosell, Burt Jones. I saw the Oilers play Monday Night Football at Memorial Stadium that night, and I just always loved the Oilers, right? Then the Colts stink right away. I was at the Ghost of the Post game with my dad. I was at the famous plane in the upper deck in Baltimore against the Steelers. I was at those games, 75, 76, 77, the Tony Linhart fog game, shake and bake that Dolphin steak, beating Shula, all that. I was at those games. I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. We lose our football team, right? So we lose our football team. I was already Earl Campbell'd up in 79, 80, 81. I was definitely Pastorini'd up. I was, because the Colts stunk. I mean, the Colts were just terrible, 78, 79, after Burke got hurt. So the Oilers were my thing, and then we lose. I was at the last game, Memorial Stadium. Earl Campbell played in that game, and we lose the team. And I'm 15 years old, and I don't have a football team. And I'm about to go through that, and I was working at the paper as an intern. John Stedman was there, and Stedman knew how much. I used to wear this jersey into work on Sunday night, every Sunday night, this jersey, 1987, 88, 89, 90. Go through all of the, you know, the Warren Moon, run and shoot, all of that. And then in 91, I got a show. Kenny Albert and I started the show on December 13th of 91. And in 92, I'm on the air without Kenny. Kenny's off being Kenny, going to do Kenny things. And I have this show, and I was just trying to book guests, and we didn't have a football team. We didn't barely had a prayer of having a football team. But I was a legitimate media member, and I knew what a PR director was. And I had been doing newspaper work for 8 years. I had been in NHL locker rooms, and I had interviewed Dr. J. I, you know, like I was a legitimate media guy, and I reached to you and I called down on Fannin Street into your cave. And I said, you know, whatever, 713-616-5552. And I said, PR, please, Chip Namius, because I'm from Baltimore. That's the way I would say it. And you picked up the phone, PR, Oilers PR. Hey, Chip, this is going to be the strangest phone call you get all day. But I'm the former music critic at Sun. I've interviewed people. I've done David Bowie and Billy Joel. I'm a legitimate guy. I'll send you. Can you maybe get a player or two on for me from time to time to make my show more fun? I don't. That's how I called you, right? That's how you met me, right? Kind of, sort of.
Yeah, that's.
Why did you put Oilers? Why did you put Jack Pardee on the phone with me? Can I, like, seriously?
Before I answer that question, you know, you mentioned Burt Jones a couple of times, and just, I talk about Burt Jones all the time. And we were just talking about him with a buddy of mine last week, because I was a huge Burt Jones fan, but Burt Jones is probably the best quarterback who's not remembered, because he was so style of play and what he was able to do and the way he played the game. That wasn't done back in that era. Burt Jones today would be a huge superstar, but you know, it crushes me that people don't remember. I know they do in Baltimore, but outside of Baltimore, people don't really remember Burt Jones, and that's a shame, because he was a talented, talented guy.
And everybody loves Burt. I mean, and I have such a crush on Burt. By the way, I think I'm getting John Waters on next week, which will I can die after that. Like, that's the end of my bucket list. But Burt would come on with me every couple years, and I've only met him once or twice. And when I've met him, he's been incredibly magnanimous. But all the reporters that covered him back then, Clark Judge loves to come on and tell Burt Jones stories, because he just loves Burt Jones. Like, yeah, everybody loved Burt.
And you also mentioned Kenny Albert. So I knew Kenny when Marv was doing games way back when I first started in the league in the early 80s. Kenny was like 15, and he was like Marv's traveling spotter. And he, you know, come with his dad to the games. And so I've known Kenny since he was a teenager, but, you know, a great guy. To answer your question, you know, why would I take pity upon you and furnish Oiler players to your show in Baltimore, which back in the early days was, you know, it was out of our market, and obviously, and who would care? You know, it was such a unique thing that you had this, you were a media guy with this Oiler passion. And, you know, how could I turn my back on that?
Well, I have all the tapes. And when a couple of years ago, when I was putting old tapes together, and I may be doing this again Super Bowl week, I have Hall of Famers that have been on my show. I'm in my 32nd year of doing radio now. So I've known you 31 years. It's my 25th anniversary this summer on August of the station. I've owned the station for 25 years this summer. And we've broadcast nonstop, and our sponsors have been great, and our audience is beautiful. And some people know of my Oiler Jones from time to time. It kind of has come up, but this sort of battle thing I've had with the Ravens, honestly, over the last 4 months, has sort of enervated my life in a lot of ways, in weird ways, where I don't really want to wear Raven swag being how they've treated me. But the honest to God truth is I've never, ever, ever thrown away anything that had Oilers on it. And part of the reason is they became a dormant franchise, right? Like, I had friends that were Browns fans and Dolphins fans and Redskins fans and Steel, you know, like, and they adopted the Ravens. It made it really weirdly easy for me. Like, in 96, we played the Oilers, and I was a Raven. I had denounced the Oilers, not denounced the Oilers, but I've been talking about the Oilers every day of my life the first 5 years on the radio, right? And by the way, just so you can, I want you to see this, Chip, because I broke this out for you. This is the Oiler fight song on the cassette tape that I used to play on the air. It says Oiler fight song on it. It says Oiler songs. So it didn't just have the Oiler song. It had the Oiler Cannonball on it. It had all of the hokey country songs from the 70s on it. It's the album. But I would cue this up and I would play, look out football, here we come. Houston Oilers number one, right? So Houston has the Oilers, the greatest football team. So, and I would, the tape would, this was the actual tape I played for 5 years back in the era of tapes. So I found this for you today. So everything I've ever had that's Oiler, I have Dan Pastorini's game used helmet from 1973. It has all of the colors of the other teams that they collided with, which is how I figured out it's a 73 helmet. And I showed it to Pastorini. I have Chip. I have a Houston Oilers trash can, and I'm not kidding you. I still have all of my stuff. So I'm
I got to jump in about the song, because, you know, the guy who did that song's name is Lee Hoffman. And I'm assuming, you know, that he did the exact same song for the Dolphins.
Yeah.
And there was always a controversy. Who had it first? Whose song really is it? And when I went from the Dolphins to the Oilers, you know, my joke was, you know, I had to only go to the Oilers because I wasn't smart enough to learn another song. I was able to keep that. But yeah, I have the song, the Oiler, the Lee Hoffman version on my iTunes. So yeah, it pops up from time to time.
So, you know, I don't collect much anymore. I've gotten rid of all of the old autographs. I keep stuff that's personal to me. I have all of my press credentials, and they're in three boxes because it's been 31 years. I mean, I've covered with a press credential, 750 NFL games easily. And I probably attended, 2000 NFL games, or like not, maybe not that, maybe 1200, because I'm thinking how many are a year. But I went to games. I went to 10 games, 12 games a year. I was an Eagles season ticket holder. I was a Colts season ticket holder. When the Colts left, I went to Eagles games. I went to Oiler home and road games in your era. I saw the Oilers play when they play the East Coast. I'd see them play five road games. Some years I'd see them play in Washington, New York, Pittsburgh, Cleveland. But I collect these belt buckles, these Pacifica rock and roll. And I know what a rock and roll guy you are, because I see all of your, next time you come on, we're going to do wrestling and oldies music, and you and I go into the Hollywood Bowl together. But this is the only thing I collect: Pacifica rock and roll belt buckles from the late 70s. And I have a box, and I can't find it right now. I was going to do it before the air. I have a box of Oiler stuff, which is like hats, sweatshirts, pom-poms, weird little trinkety Christmas ornaments, keychain, just stuff that I had that I never got rid of because the Oilers were dormant, right? And they're not hurting anyone. It's that blue helmet behind you only means stuff to people it means stuff to. And when I've gone on eBay, like, you can buy an Earl Campbell jersey like this for $25 in any size, and a Warren Moon, when you can get it in white, get it in blue, because they were made, and now nobody reps it, right? Like, to your point, the players are like lost. How was that thing in October? That's the weirdest thing, because none of our guys, Stan White would never go to Indianapolis to claim, John Mackey, none of the guys here would do that. I mean, it was very, very North and South Korea, right? Like, you just didn't do it. And I would think, and I know I talked to Pastorini about this, and I'm sure I talked to John McClain. Did the Texans just not do anything for these cats? I mean, I'm wondering.
What about the Texans or the Titans?
the Texans. Like, wait, they lived in Houston. Like, well, did the Texans not want to, like, embrace Dan Pastorini? I mean, that's kind of crazy, well, right?
Of course they did. In fact, it's funny you bring that up because I've had a lot of conversations with Oiler players that were in Houston when the Titans organization wasn't really paying attention to them. And the Texans tried to jump on that when they first started out with all these former Oiler players in town. The Texans, of course, didn't have a history, so they tried to steal the Oilers' history and make some of these Oiler players in Houston Texans ambassadors, give them blazers with the Texans ambassadors patch. And to their credit, most of the guys declined. And they said, you know, hey, we appreciate that you want to bring us into the Texans fold, but we're not Texans. We didn't spill our blood for the Texans. We don't have any roots with the Texans. Our organization is the Oilers, and hopefully the Titans will do the right thing and make us feel part of the family, which, as I mentioned, you know, throwing bouquets at the feet of Amy Adams is what she's doing. And in fact, she and I talked about this at the Oilers reunion in October, that the Texans had tried to do that. And Amy got her back up a little bit, and she said, you know, they're not going to steal. Those are my players. Those Oilers players, those are my players. They're not going to. She was pissed that they were, you know, trying to steal her players. And she said, that's why we're going to keep doing what we're doing. We're going to have this lavish reunion every year. And I'm going to make those guys feel a part of this. And that's what she's doing. But yeah, the Texans tried, but it didn't work.
But she owns the Derek, right? She owns the markings, right? I mean, it's still a property of the Titans, correct?
I assume it must be, because they will sometimes wear throwback uniforms and they sell Oilers licensed merchandise in their gift shop. So yeah, I'm sure they still do own the marks.
Well, the one time they wore the old throwbacks, they got crushed by the Patriots in the snow, right? And lost 50-0 or something like that. And they were wearing the cool, the appropriate throwbacks, as I would say, from that era. How much stuff do you have? I have a box, and I'm literally, I told my wife this, I'm going to see Springsteen in Houston in a couple of weeks, right? And I just have hours there. I have a cousin that lives there, some good friends, but I'm going to go down Westheimer and vintage shop, and I may pick up a couple of trinkets and make a little room for the Oilers can never do me wrong. You always did me right. Even Warren Moon does me right when I bump into him these days. People treat me right. But I love my memories of the Oilers. And it must be what it's like to be a Bills fan. They never win, right? I mean, you never climb the mountain. I got a story for you, because I Jimmy Schwartz, I already pimped him out and talked about him getting the Browns job. And he's running the OC. In 2003, the Ravens got eliminated by the Titans in Baltimore in a playoff game, wild card game. Orlando Brown, the late Orlando Brown, had a penalty, moved the Joe Nedney up 15 yards. They beat us, knocked us out of the playoffs. I think the Titans lost to the Patriots the next week. It was 5 degrees or something. And about 3 months later, Rush opened their tour in Nashville. And Schwartz and I we're boys, right? The E.R. Peterson, Dundalk, rock and roll guys. So Schwartz, I'm flying to Nashville to hang out with Schwartz to go see Rush. And I flew in the morning, and he comes out to the airport, picks me up. I'm in the passenger seat. He's like, hey, you got to stop by the office. Okay, you're a defensive coordinator. It's May, but okay, if you got to work, fine, you know. So we stop by the office, and he takes me onto the Cumberland River, and he takes me into, at that time, the old facility. It was like an old airport airplane hangar. It wasn't as nice as what we have here in Owings Mills. And I walked in, and the first thing he did was take me into the cafeteria there. And the cafeteria is the Oilers cafeteria in 2003, right? I mean, the Titans had 4 years of history. They had played in a Super Bowl, right? They had their own thing, but it's Bud's team, Bud's alive. Dude, I went into that cafeteria and it was just all Oiler. And he said, I thought you'd like this. And then he proceeded to take me upstairs, lock me in a room, and make me watch his team kicking my team's ass out of the playoffs. So he tortured me. And then we went and saw Rush. It was a great night. We had a good time. I don't remember anything after that. But I do remember it was like being in Disney World for me. There was that moment where you get that feeling that the logo makes you feel, or the Derek, and all of a sudden you meet Earl Campbell and you're in Dallas one night and there is Earl Campbell. And he offered to let me sit on his lap and take a picture, Chip, you know? And then Dan Pastorini spent a whole evening with me after my wife had cancer down at an Astros game. And these, I'm a kid again. You know what I mean? Does that make any sense to you? I'll never be a kid around Ray Lewis. I can be a professional and I love Ray and I love the Ravens and I love the, I have a Super Bowl, like all of that. But the Oilers are the innocence in me. Does that mean any, is that, you almost made me cry, but does that weird because they're dead that it's okay for me to wear this?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm, the way you described, that's how I still am with the New York Yankees, because when I was 5 years old, my dad took me to my first game and that cemented my loyalty to the Yankees. And, you know, when I'm around the Yankees, it still kind of, you know, brings out the kid in you. No, that's all great. And, you know, it was so, for me, it was so meaningful being at that reunion in October and getting to be around those guys. And I was explaining this to somebody recently, what was really special to me, like when I was working with those guys as the PR guy, I mean, they're players and I'm the PR guy. I'm always asking them to do stuff or whatever. But what was really special and unexpected for me when I was at that reunion was they treated me like I was a player. I mean, it wasn't like, yeah, we're Saul hanging out with each other. Oh yeah, and there's Chip, he used to work in the front office. No, they made me feel like I was just as much a part of it as they were. And I was like, seeing me and hanging around me was just as valuable to them and meaningful to them as it was to me. And to them, it's like I was a former teammate. And that was unexpected. And that really made me feel even better about what was a very special weekend.
Chip, I have been treated that way for 21 years by the members of the Super Bowl 35 team. And we lost Tony last year, but when they come to town, they call me and we wind up going out and having good times, whether it's Jack Del Rio or Kim Herring, and these, and they won a Super Bowl, and it's, and obviously it's different. I was media, but they were coming out doing my show on Monday night, drinking beer. We were the same age. It was total innocence to get the franchise here and then to win a Super Bowl with some of those guys, Marvin. I mean, I talked to Marvin last week, right? And now they're being immortalized in this Baltimore Bullies thing that's happening next week on 30 for 30 as well. But the Oiler players of that era being wayward and coming back and doing this, is it weird flying into that? Was that is unprecedented, right? Like what they were doing, because the Rams have a problem with that, right? Like I would go to St. Louis to see Jack Youngblood's name on the wall. Jack Youngblood had nothing to do with St. Louis, right? And you would see those sort of, you know, Roman Gabriel weird things that went on. But I would think for the living souls, and these were all young guys when the franchise, I mean, Warren Moon's still a young guy, right? That to have some sort of football home, even for you, that weekend was 20 years in the making though, right? Literally.
Yeah. But you know, when you look back on it, you know, how the Oilers, you know, what happened when they left was all very predictable. I mean, we all knew what was going to happen at the time it was happening. You know, Bud was trying to get the city to give money for a new stadium. The Astrodome was not really a football facility. It was, you know, even then it was kind of in disrepair. And as I mentioned, it wasn't a football specific place. So it had a lot of nuances to it that weren't great. And, you know, if Bud had been a more popular figure in Houston, which he was not, he probably would have gotten a stadium deal done. The Oilers would have gotten their deal. The team would have never moved and there would be no Tennessee Titans. But there was a lot of animosity towards Bud from the citizens of Houston, the politicians in Houston. As I said, he wasn't a popular guy and he wasn't a really good schmoozer. So when it came time to putting his hand out and trying to get a stadium deal done, there weren't people really lining up to help him. And so we knew what was going to happen. Bud was going to move the team. Somebody else would eventually come in who would be more popular, would get a new stadium. It would end up costing the city of Houston and the Harris County taxpayers way more money than it would have ever cost them to just help Bud. And that's what happened. You know, Bud's unpopularity. He didn't get a deal done. He moved the team. Bob McNair came in. The city of Houston built him a stadium, the county and the city, and it cost way more than it would have if they had just done what Bud had asked at the time. But it was an unpopular owner. And, you know, and to some extent, maybe that's mirrors a little bit what happened with Art there.
Chip Namius is our guest, the one-time Houston Oilers PR director. You were there in 93, 94, or were you gone at that point?
I was there. I got there in 86 and went to the Bucks in 94.
Okay. I was credentialed.
I missed the move by a year, which.
Okay. I only went to one Oiler game in Houston. It was a Holy Grail moment for me. The Giants played the Oilers in a really bad Monday night football game with Dan Dierdorf, Colin Culler. I sat with Ernie Accorsi for a long period of time that night. He was the GM of the Giants. And it was the first night that Jeff Fisher coached the Oilers. So whenever that was, I think it was November 94. I was in Texas to see the Rolling Stones at the Cotton Bowl too. So I made a weekend of it. I actually went to Irving Stadium to see the Cowboys play the Redskins. It was Thanksgiving weekend, 94. So I guess you were gone at that point. But also, I want to say, so you went to Tampa and Sombrero with the Culver House folks. You were in Miami with Joe Robbie and with legendary PR people there, and Harvey and obviously Don Shula and all of that, and Dan Marino as well. But the Pele thing, a couple of weeks ago, Pele died. About 4 months ago, you put up this series of pictures in Memphis, Tennessee, in the old Mid-South Coliseum, where I've never been, by the way. I have been to the Liberty Bowl to see the Oilers play in 97. But you put a couple of pictures up, and we're Facebook friends, and we have a good time, and I comment on all your oldies music stuff with the Turtles and Happy Together and all that good stuff, the throwback stuff, monkey stuff that you see. But the people that you've associated with, I mean, you brought Burt Reynolds by on Radio Row. You brought Adam Sandler by my show, and you've been around a lot of amazing things. I mean, you've really led this weaving. You're a lot more than the Oilers PR director, Chip Namius.
I appreciate that, Nestor. Yeah, no, it was from the Dolphins to the Oilers to the Buccaneers, and then working in my own sports PR firm for the last 20 years and doing PR campaigns for sports movies has been fun. You know, getting to you know, first work with athletes and then work with movie people. Very different, very different. You know, when I first started doing that, I was going to be interested in my own head to see what were going to be the primary differences in working with athletes and movie stars. And there were a lot of differences. It wasn't what I expected. I was expecting that athletes were going to be tougher because athletes have really been treated special for longer than movie stars. Movie stars had normal high school lives and college lives, where athletes, you know, maybe since they were 8 years old, they've been treated as if they were special. Things have been paths have been paved for them. Not so much with movie stars who didn't become famous until they got into adulthood, but it's a lot harder to deal with the movie industry than it is with the athletes, because there's so many more layers. When you're dealing with a Kevin Costner and Jennifer Garner and Adam Sandler, they can be great, but there's managers and publicists and agents and studio executives and blah, blah, blah. And that can be a, you know, kind of a trippy thing to go through.
But athletes win and lose, right? You know what I mean? Like, the losing part of being an athlete, I don't ever take that for granted. I mean, I've been doing this, you know, 31 years on the radio, but 39 years I've been in locker rooms. I mean, I Gene Ubriaco was the first coach I ever went up to with a notebook. I was 15 years old. I'm 54. You know, I've been doing this a long, long time. But every game I've ever gone to, half of the people are pissed. They lost. And usually, you know, and so if you get blown out, you're pissed. If you lose the last bucket or, you know, the losing side of it, there's a humility part of losing and an acceptance of defeat to some degree, and at least facing defeat, that makes being an athlete. You know, I'm sitting at the locker with Lee Evans after he dropped the pass, and sitting at the locker with Billy Cundiff after he missed the kick that would have gone to the Super Bowl. I mean, you talk about those Oilers players loving you and treating you like not Chip the PR guy, but maybe Chip the long snapper or the kicker or the punter, like you're at the edge of the roster? Because you were in there crying with them when they lost in Buffalo that day, and you were on the plane back, and it hurt you as much as it hurt them, right? I mean, it really, and I know that about everyone that works for teams. And I've talked about that with Chad Steele, Kevin Byrne, everywhere down. I respect, how hard it is for you to get the cornerback that got toasted on the Jacoby Jones pass and get him out to say a few things to the media about the play, and that how hard that is to do in the modern era. It was hard in your era. It's much harder in the modern era.
Yeah, it is hard, but that's one of the things that you miss when you don't work for a team, is that, besides the structure of, like, whether you're a player or a PR guy, your Monday is your Monday, your Tuesday is you know how each day of the week is going to play out, whether you're a PR guy or you're a player. And you, when you're the PR guy, unlike maybe the ticket person or the salesperson who's not working with the players, in PR, you're in the locker room every day. You're on the field during the, for part of the games. So when that scoreboard shows you at the end of the game whether you won or lost, it's not just, you don't just feel it as a player, you feel it as a staff person, whether you won or lost. It hurt me inside when we lost. The week was different after you lost than it was after you won. And, you knew that was just a part of it. But, the highs were high and the lows were low. And, I was fortunate enough to be with two teams that competed in the Super Bowl. And that was, unbelievable. And, but you can't replicate that in the business world. I mean, it's not the same.
Pele, I got to ask you about Pele, and then I got to get a Jerry Lawler story, and I'm going to let you go. And I'll have you back on, and we'll do no sports at all, and it'll just be only music, good music, before 1980. That's it. Music before 1980 will be our next category with Chip Namias, former longtime PR guy in sports and entertainment and my friend. But before all of this football stuff, you were trying to kick off the little Euro thing. They were kicking the ball in the shorts back in the 70s. Man, you were on the pitch with Pele, literally, right, as a kid.
Well, no, not really. I worked, you're right, I worked in the NASL for three teams, the Memphis Rogues, the Tulsa Roughnecks, and the Fort Lauderdale Strikers. But Pele had just stopped playing when I came into the league in 78. But I did get to meet him a few times, and be around him a few times, which was pretty incredible.
Pele in 1978 is the most famous man in the world, literally, right?
Well, when Pele passed away, a few weeks ago, we were talking about this, and I think that as far as an athlete, being a member of the club where you can show up in any country on the planet and people immediately recognize you, it's a two-member club. It's Pele and Muhammad Ali. I think those are the only members of that club who can show up on any planet and people will immediately know who they are. So that's pretty rarefied air. Two people in the history of sports who can make that claim.
I met Ali once, and I'm still bragging about it. And you know how I knew Pele was a big deal? My buddy Phil Jackman, and love Phil, send the love out to his family. He's still with us, but not fully capable, certainly not coming on the show. And I have a bunch of old tapes that I'm shining up to keep his voice and his magic alive. But he was a bit of he was a mentor. He was a crazy uncle to me. He was a, father figure. And we in the 80s, when I was the Cubs sports writer, 85, 86, 87, when I was wearing my Oiler jersey in his car going to Capitals games back in the day, he would always say to me, kid, I covered them all the fight. He covered Ali fights, Sugar Ray, like all hockey, basketball, all of that. I only one time I got an autograph. I was at a conference with Pele. I threw the program up there. I have one autograph, Pele. And he would always, and this is in the 80s, he would say that to me. I'm like, man, Phil's like, Phil's got integrity on the up and up, but like Pele broke him down. You know what I mean? I mean, McCartney would do that to you and me, right? Jerry the King, you mentioned this childhood in Memphis. I've been meaning to ask you because I'm trying to get Jerry the King on the show and you're trying to facilitate and organize and the King came on and regaled me with stories one time about 25 years ago at a Raw is War. That night I had Jerry Lawler, The Rock, Vince McMahon. I mean, I had a hell of a show that night. We'll break that one out one night too. But your association with the King and wrestling in Memphis, because I saw you taking pictures. That arena is iconic. The only arena that looks even a little bit like it's the Hershey Park Arena.
Well, there was another arena, the Jacksonville Arena, which has since been torn down. There's the Mid-South Coliseum we're talking about, where the Beatles performed, Elvis performed, you know, Michael Jackson, you know, Memphis State basketball when it was big in the 70s, when they went to the Final Four against Bill Walton, and, you know, all the iconic events that have been held in that building. They're trying to save it. I don't know if it's going to be successful. They're talking about tearing it down to use that space for an outdoor soccer stadium for the equivalent of an MLS AAA team. But, you know, I sure hope it gets saved. But, you know, I'm pretty good friends with Jerry Lawler. As a kid, I was a huge wrestling fan and used to go see Jerry wrestle when I was in college and in high school. And then I got to meet him in the late 80s at a NATB, which is a National Television Syndication Convention. I met him there in the late 80s, and we've been friends ever since. When I go back to Memphis to visit my family, I always see Jerry. I was there in November, saw Jerry like three times. And, you know, the best story about, you know, Jerry is when I would be in Memphis visiting family, when they had the old Saturday morning live wrestling show. And I would, you know, Jerry would say, hey, come on down with me to wrestling, down to the TV station. I'd go down with him. So this one particular time, I go down with him for the live hour and a half wrestling show, which was iconic in Memphis. And we're backstage, and he throws me a referee shirt. And he says, you're going to referee a match on TV today. And so I'm like in shock. I mean, I've watched wrestling long enough to know what a referee does, but to go and do it on live TV when you've never done it once in your life.
Was it one of his matches, or was it a bum match? What kind of match was it?
It wasn't one of his matches, but it wasn't a bum. It was his son, Brian Christopher, who's since passed away, and a couple other guys. And there was going to be an angle in the match. I don't know if you remember a guy named Mabel.
Okay.
Remember Mabel?
Sure.
Mabel was a WWE wrestler who was about 600 pounds. And the gimmick of the match was, when there was going to be a pin, I was supposed to count slow. And before I would get to three, Mabel would run in from the outside, clear the ring, interfere in the match, blah, 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 create mayhem and so forth. Well, two things happened that were noteworthy. Number one, so I've never done this. So the guy's on the pin and I'm counting. And I've been told, don't go to three. So I'm like, one, two, where's the outside interference? I'm waiting. Finally, Mabel shows up. Now, before I finish the story, I got chastised later, because I guess it's an unwritten rule. If the wrestler misses his mark and doesn't get in the ring when he's supposed to, you can't mess with the credibility. You got to go three. So I didn't know that. I was going by what I was told. Anyway, Mabel runs in the ring. He creates mayhem. He's tossing guys out of the ring. He's beating up everybody. And so finally, he's throwing everybody out of the ring, and it's just him and me. And this is live TV. Now, Jerry has told everybody backstage, don't mess with my friend Chip. He's not a real referee. He's never done this before, you know, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, there's all this excitement. The fans are going crazy. Everybody's been thrown out of the ring. Mabel's the last man standing, except for me, the referee. So suddenly he looks at me, and I'm thinking, this is not going to end well. So he comes over, and he literally picks me up, and he throws me over the top rope. Now, I don't know how to land. I'm not an experienced guy. Fortunately, there's padding out there. I landed on the padding. The fans are going crazy. Now, I'm smart enough to know I've got to writhe around in pain here for a while before I ultimately get up. So then they go to a commercial. The famous wrestling announcer, Lance Russell, goes to a commercial, but there's still a live audience there. And I'm about to get up and kind of make my way back to the locker room when I hear Mabel shouting out, now just playing to the fans in the studio because they're in a commercial break. He goes, where's that referee? And I can see under the ring, his feet coming around towards me. And I'm going, this is also not going to end well. So he picks me up by the hair and he says, no referee should wear glasses. He pulls my glasses off my head. He puts them down on the corner, on the floor, on the mat. He gets back in the ring. He gets up on the top rope and he jumps off the top rope onto the mat and smashes my glasses into about a million pieces. And then he goes back to the locker room. I limp back to the locker room, still playing that I'm hurt from being thrown over the top rope. As soon as that door closed, I MF'd and screamed at Jerry and everybody back there, you know, what the heck is going on? You know, I got thrown over the top rope. Mabel smashed my glasses. It was not a great experience, but I have the videotape of the whole thing.
I was going to ask, you have evidence of that, right?
I don't have evidence of the breaking my glasses because that was during a commercial break, but I have the videotape of me being thrown over the top rope.
You have lived a full life. I knew there was a better story. There was a story behind those pictures of you and Jerry Lawler, and I knew I'd get it out of you. So I'm glad that you finally broke kayfabe and decided to kind of come on the show here. Chip Namias is the longtime, one-time Houston Oilers PR director who coddled me and took care of me in my early Nasty Nester phase in 1991, 92, 93, fishing me Oilers. You got me Haywood Jeffries. You got me Chris Dishman.
Jeffries, by the way, is if you said name your absolute favorite player of all years in the NFL who means the most to your heart, Haywood Jeffries. Love that guy.
So you do know you got him for me. You got me Chris Dishman. You got me Bubba McDowell. You got me Jack Pardee, which I'm eternally grateful because he's a Hall of Famer, and that's added to my Hall of Fame collection of interviews. But and you also got me credentialed at a preseason game in 1993 in Detroit at the Silver Dome. And I went into the locker room, into your locker room, into the cages of the visiting locker room in the big bubble, and I had Oiler players record. I didn't know I was going to say this, Chip. I'm just thinking, I'm making this up as I go along. But I went to players in your locker room, and they all did bumpers for me. And I remember meeting Ernest Givens, who was about my size, and I loved Ernest Givens, right? Like, he caught big balls, caught third downs, made plays, run and shoot, the whole deal. And I went up to Ernest Givens, and I said, hi, Ernest, I'm Nestor from Baltimore. I do this radio show. Chip let me in. Can you do a bumper for me? And I had, hey, this is Ernest Givens from the Houston Oilers, and you're listening to the Sports Forum with Nasty Nestor Aparicio on WITHAM. Call the show, 410-481-5. So it was a script, and Ernest Givens gave me this sly handshake. He's like, call me EG, baby. And I remember this 30 years later that Ernest Givens said to me, call me EG, baby. And I thought to myself, I'm glad I root for you, Ernest Givens. Thank you very much. So I remember all this, all these years later. I didn't get near Warren Moon, and he didn't play. It was a preseason game, you know, this kind of thing. But I have all the bumpers. They're on a tape, just like the Oiler fight song. And wow. I am eternally grateful, not just to your friendship and our friendship, and that I owe you a beer for doing this and breaking kayfabe and coming on and telling your stories. But the next time we're going to do Hollywood Bowl and why I need to get there. Okay.
The next time I got to give you a couple of Don Shula stories. Got some good ones on that as well.
I really screwed up because Fudge offered me Don Shula several times in the end of his life and Harvey too, because I was working on a book on Baltimore coaches and I kind of put it down. I just, we never made it happen. You know what I mean? It was, I effed up. I know I effed up. I met Mr. Shula. I've had him on the show. I have had him. I have pictures. By the way, I have a picture of him in the Ursay dummy in Indianapolis like 10 years ago. It's legendary. I'll send it over. You'll get a big chuckle out of it.
You have time for me to tell one Don Shula story?
All I have is time for you, Chip Namias. Go ahead, man. Let's do it. Give me Don Shula story.
It's my favorite Shula story. I wasn't there when it happened. I wish I had been, but it predated me. It was after the Dolphins had gone to their first Super Bowl, which they lost in, 73? Or excuse me, 71, 70, whenever it was, they lost the Super Bowl and before the 72 undefeated season. And Shula and his wife, Dorothy, they had three kids at the time. They took them up for vacation during the off season to a coastal island in Maine. And they were, you know, off the coast of Maine. They were walking around. It's like 7:30 at night. They had already had dinner. They decided, you know, it's too early to take the little kids back to the hotel and put them to bed. What can
little kids? They're future coaches there, right? Mike, Dave, right? Okay, sure, right.
What can we do with the little kids at 7:30 at night? We've had our dinner. Let's kill a little time. So this small coastal Maine town, there's a movie theater. It's like, let's take them to the movies. So they walk in the movie theater. Don, Dorothy, three of the kids, and they come in. The lights are still on in the movie theater, and they're walking down the ramp in the theater. They come in, finding seats. There was hardly anybody in the theater. And the few people that were in there turned around and saw Coach Shula and his family, and they started applauding. And Coach Shula turns to his wife, and he goes, "Hey, God, all the way up here in Maine, they know me. I guess it's from the Super Bowl we just lost." So he's doing his presidential wave to the few people in the theater, and he and his kids and his wife find their seats and take their coats off and, you know, watch the movie. And so when the movie's over, the lights come on, Coach Shula's gathering his family. They're gathering up all their belongings and making their way out of the theater. And this man in the little small crowd rushes up to him and he says, "I want to shake your hand." And Coach Shula shakes his hand. He goes, "Oh, are you a big Dolphins fan?" And the guy says, "Dolphins fan? I don't know what you're talking about, but the manager said, we didn't have 10 people in here. They weren't going to start the movie."
Coach Shula, man, made a nice steak too, as I remember it too. So,
still does.
Yeah,
still does.
Absolutely, man. And I, you know, I loved having you on. You made me break out my Oiler stuff and my mug and my trash can and my Oiler fight song. Somewhere around here, there's pom-poms and tree ornaments and different things. And at some point, I'm going to add to the legacy and the lore of the defunct franchise. Look out, football. Here we come, Houston. Almost looks like Patriot Pat a little bit in that light, but it is a Houston Oiler mug. Chip, thanks for coming on and being a good friend all these years and making my show better.
Thanks, Nestor. Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
A real professional, PR professional. Chip Namias, longtime Oiler PR director, as well as the Buccos, as well as the Dolphins and the Fort Lauderdale Strikers back in the day, and doing Hollywood things around here. On our next presentation of Remember the Oilers, I will play the Oiler Cannonball and make everyone laugh. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. And even when our football team gets bounced out, we're still talking football around here. It's BaltimorePositive.com. Stay with us.